Good evening. My name is Michael Berg. I'm an alcoholic. Figure out where we're going to put that. Okay. Okay. Let's see. Christy, where are you? I want to thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me out. It's always good to come to Laguna. There's so many familiar faces, and you guys are so welcoming. I'm pretty sure after my talk you won't be, but that's all right. I'm used to that. I want to thank Mike. I want to thank you for your talk tonight. I got to tell you, I love the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I can come to a meeting and look, I might be playing it cool, but I'm nervous. Okay, I am nervous. And that's how I get. Like, you know, Chris asked me a few minutes ago, "Are you nervous?" I'm like, "No, man, I'm not. I'm cool." You know, but I'm not. I was lied to him. And but when I sit down in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and it starts, you know, and then Mike, you talk, it's like, you know, it's like when I used to drink and I used to go to a bar. It's like I'd walk in, I would just be that. Just get away from me. Let me have a drink, you know. And I would take that. That first drink, and I would get that ease and comfort, you know, and it's just like, you know. So, Mike, thank you very much for that ease and comfort you've given me tonight. I appreciate it. My sobriety date is November 26, 2009. It was Thanksgiving that year. I'm not somebody that's going to tell you, oh no, wait to get sober. But if it falls on a holiday and you've got to spend it with family, take a couple. You know, tomorrow's another day. You know, it was a rough day. You know, it's like family was following me all through, you know, throughout dinner, and it's like, you know, if I was in the bathroom too long, somebody would knock on the door. Michael, are you okay in there? And it's like, yeah, you know, and. Unbeknownst to me, though, I was going somewhere that night. But some of you have gone somewhere those nights too. My home group is the Covina group. They're meeting tonight. It's the Sunday night speaker meeting. Which is, you know, why I'm sure any minute some of them are going to call and ask where I'm at. Any minute now. Just maybe not getting reception here. I don't know. I'm sure they know I'm gone. I'm sure they're not. Where's Michael? You know, it's any minute, any second now. Oh, whatever. You know, I'm sure there'll be lots of messages when I get down. And my sponsor is a guy named Carl. He's I entered into a relationship a long time ago with him where it's like I don't have to. I don't have to like what he says. I don't have to think it's a good idea. I just have to do it, you know. And when I seem to follow that recipe, it's life seems to be okay. You know? I don't know. In my opinion, he's got a lot of bad ideas for my life. But whatever, it's just whatever, Carl. All right, I'll do it. You know? I grew up very young. I grew up in a very loving home. My parents, I have a sister, she's a couple of years older than me. And just growing up, you know, our parents, they surrounded us with a lot of love. They surrounded us with people in our lives who were very, very loving and good people. My mom, she's a third generation Japanese American, and her mom, my bachan, she was interned in the Japanese internment camps during World War II. She has an amazing story of forgiveness, but tonight's not about her; it's about me. And my mom was also she was a hippie in the 60s and 70s. She used to hitchhike up to Golden Gate Park in San Francisco, and there were like a lot of free concerts in the park. She just told me stories of seeing Janis Joplin get her start there, and the Grateful Dead, and things like that, And I knew at a very young age the difference between I just slipped his name. Who was the big promoter back then in the 60s and 70s? Had the similar name to a reverend. But anyways, My dad is a white guy who was a deacon at a Lutheran church. And to this day, I'm not sure who was trying to convert who when they met, but their wedding is the result of a joint, a Bible, and the conception of my sister. And I'm pretty sure it was in that order. growing up was always kind of weird at my house because on Saturday nights, the hippie commune would come over and they'd all party, you know, and they'd smoke cigarettes like this, which was always interesting. Yeah. They smelled kind of funny. Like, that smells funny. Go to bed, you know. And then on Sunday mornings, we'd be in church. I got drunk for the first time when I was 12 years old. I had a friend, he spent the night at my house. We got into my parents' liquor cabinet, and we were taking swigs of vodka. And I don't remember much from that night. Like I didn't have this like great aha moment, right? Like I don't remember like the heavens parting for me that night. I don't remember getting any taller. I don't remember getting any cuter. I was cute enough as a 12-year-old, I feel like. But it's really cute. But what I do remember so vividly from that night was that there was this driving force behind that bottle. Like I could not stop taking swigs. Now, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it calls this the phenomenon of craving. And it tells me that I have an allergy to the body. All right, like I'm a pretty healthy guy. Like this is the only allergy I've got. So far I'm not allergic to cats, bee stings, or strawberries. But if I was allergic to any one of those things, well, I'd imagine I wouldn't own a cat. I would avoid bees at all costs, and I wouldn't eat strawberries. But there's this other part to this disease that we call alcoholism, and that's the obsession of the mind. And that's that thing in me that's going to rationalize and justify my walk back to the next drink, no matter what the cost. It doesn't matter the pain and suffering that I went through a day, a week, or even a month ago. And that obsession of the mind, it's also that thing in me that's going to make it impossible for me to get comfortable sober. Now, like, you know, before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and worked these 12 steps, those were two things that I've been trying to get to converge on my life at the same time. Like I was either comfortable, which meant I was drunk, okay, or I was sober, which meant I was irritable, restless, and discontent. I just couldn't marry the two together. This phenomenon of craving I spoke of, it only occurred to me that night. My friend, he like took a swig and a half, he coughed, and he went to bed. Loser. but man, I just remember like, you know, like, okay, one more swig and I'll go to bed, you know, one more swig and I'll go to bed, you know, and I don't know, I couldn't wait for him to spend the night again. That was fun, you know. Bless you. I know high school was kind of just that. It was just high. I don't know any other way to explain my high school career. I was one of those guys. I was the guys with a group that were, you know, in the alley behind school, were smoking cigarettes, smoking pot, whatever, you know, and drinking, you know, and we each took a turn during the week to raid our parents' liquor cabinet, you know, in the spirit of rotation, of course. It's like I learned that early on. You know, that was my high school career. And, you know, I had friends. I had a lot of friends, but I never felt like I fit in. Like the only times really that I felt like I fit in was when I was drinking. I mean, you get a few drinks in me, I fit in with the freaks, the geeks, the jocks, and the sluts. I'm like in with everybody, you know, especially the sluts. You're like, by the time I was 22 years old, I was drinking in bars and nightclubs on a daily and a nightly basis. And already at this time in my life, I know that when I walk into a bar or a club and I start drinking, I know that I'm going to be unavailable for either the next 2 days, a week, a month. I just don't know which one it's going to be. And what's happening at this time in my life is exactly what the Big Book talks about, that I have lost the power of choice, right? That I was no longer in control. My mind was just using me for transportation back to the next drink. And now, obviously, when you're drinking as much as I was back then, blackouts occur, and I had plenty of them. And like, I never came out of a blackout and, like, you know, like my taxes were done, you know, or, you know, I come out of a blackout and, like, my laundry's all neatly folded and put away, you know. I always came to out of blackouts in places and situations that I really didn't want to be in. I remember this one time I came out of this blackout and I was completely naked in bed with a naked woman. And the only reason I wanted out of that situation is because I'm gay. That's not funny, you guys. I had no clue what I was for a couple of days, okay? I was like, you know, maybe I'm nuts. I don't know. I, you know, it's like, well, Dad's gonna be proud now, you know. Dad was not proud. He was just as confused as I was. It's like, you know, I thought you were, you know. Yes, Dad, I'm still out. You guys ever come out of a blackout and wish you can go back into it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right? Like, okay, like my blacked out mind got us into this situation. Like, you know, it can get us out, you know. You know, like you come out of a blackout and like you just close your eyes and you squeeze, you know. Remember this one time I came out of this blackout and I'm driving my car. It's like 3 o'clock in the morning and I'm in South Central. Which is not a good neighborhood, especially at 3 o'clock in the morning. And there is a bum putting cologne on in my car. slam on the brakes, get him out of the car. I don't know, out of there. And shortly after that, I got into a relationship with this guy who was going to law school, and just right out of the gate, he hated my drinking, just absolutely hated my drinking. And he said it changed me. Thought it made him more tolerable, but and we would do this thing, like I would hide flasks and little bottles of booze all throughout the apartment, and he would go through, he would find them and he would throw them away. It was this really toxic game of hide and seek that nobody liked. And I would start fights with him on purpose because he would make me sleep on the couch when we fought. And he never found that one bottle of vodka that like I kept tucked underneath the couch, right? Like right to the back and to the right. And I remember this one night, I just needed that drink, you know? And so, you know, I just started to fly with it and I knew which buttons to push. I was getting good at this, you know? And so we just launched right into this flight and we're going back and forth. And now he's making points with A, B, and C's. And, I'm like, those law classes are really starting to pay off. And all of a sudden he grabs his pillow and a blanket and he storms out of the room. I'm like, where are you going? He goes, I'm sleeping on the couch tonight. And I'm like, wait a second. I'm sorry. And so now like I'm pacing in the room. I'm like, what am I going to do? I'm like, I don't have anything else. And so like, you know, I can finally hear him like breathing heavily, you know, and like he's sleeping. And so like at 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm doing this SEAL Team 6 crawl across the living room floor. And I'm like reaching underneath the couch and I'm like, it's in the back, but it's to the right. And is that my right or his right? You know, and I'm doing this whole thing, you know, and all of a sudden I hear this, I threw it away, now go to bed. And I'm like, no. That was a rough night. There was this one evening where we were just having this really, really nice evening, you know, and we'd made dinner and we were gonna watch a movie at home and we were just having this really nice night, laughing, talking all throughout dinner, you know, and we're doing the dishes, we're just laughing and joking, you know, and I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, man, I'm doing good. I'm doing so good. Like I haven't had a drink tonight. I haven't needed a drink. I haven't even thought of a drink. Man, I'm doing good. And then that next thought came, which was, you know what, Michael? You are doing good. You've done real good tonight, buddy. Yeah. You deserve a drink tonight. And I'm like, now I'm thinking like, well, no, I don't have anything in the apartment. Where am I going to go? And I was like, well, we do need some popcorn. Let's go get some popcorn real quick. And I'm like, that's a great idea. You know, and And so I'm like, babe, I'll be right back. I'm gonna go get popcorn for the movie. I'll be right back. I'll be back in you know, in a few minutes. And the bar I used to drink at used to be in the same shopping center as the grocery store. And so, you know, the plan was, okay, I'm just gonna run into the bar real quick. I'll take a quick shot. I'll run into the grocery store, get some popcorn, be home, 3 minutes tops, right? So I run into the bar and I'm like, give me a shot, you know, take a shot. And I look at my watch and it's only been 40 seconds. Let's do another one. Let's have one more shot, you know, I'll take one more shot, you know. Took another shot, I look at my watch, I'm like, 90 seconds. I'm doing good on time, I'm doing really good on time. One more, let's do one more, you know. I took another shot and I think I got home around like 3:30 in the morning and locked out of the bedroom again, passed out on the couch. And you know, I came to the next morning and I walked into the kitchen and there he was, you know, at the kitchen table with that look in his eyes. You know, it's that look. And it's that look that I've seen so many times before, not only from him, but from anybody. From anybody who had any amount of care and love for me in my life has had that look on their face at some point in my life. And it's that look of, how could you? How could you do this? And he said that. He said, how could you do this again? How could you do this? You promised you wouldn't do this again. How could you? And I don't know. I don't know if I was just too hungover, too tired, or just out of excuses. But for some reason, that morning, I told him the truth. And the truth was, I don't know. I don't know. Because I don't know. I don't know why when I drink, I'm dying to have another drink. And when I'm not drinking, all I'm thinking about is drinking again. I don't know these things. I'm not going to know these things until I come to you guys and you take me through the doctor's opinion and you teach me about the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. But until then, I have no clue why I drink the way I do. He told me right there, he said, you know, it's either me or the booze. And without hesitation, just like that, I said, then you've got to go. You got to go. Because, you know, make no mistake about it. If you get in the way of me and my booze, it's you that has to go, not the booze. Although I probably should have thought about it for a little bit longer because he's now an attorney for Google. Yes, that stings. That would have been a nice divorce. Not have driven a Honda up here, that's for sure. Totally would have gotten that beach house in the doors. Shortly thereafter, I moved to the San Fernando Valley. My neighbors, they you know, realized very quickly that they were living next to the town drunk because I would, for some reason, park my car on the lawn in the middle of the night. It was closer distance to my door, but one night I was driving up to San Luis Obispo. The cops pulled me over. They found what they too considered some outside issues, and they took me to jail. And I remember you know, spending the weekend in jail that weekend, and I looking around, sitting in that jail cell. I was not thinking, my God, look at where I'm at. This is a direct result of the actions that I have been changing, have been taking. I need to change. I was not thinking that. What I was really thinking was, I'm looking around, going, I'm sure somebody's making some booze around here. You know, that's what my thought was. And for the next 3 years, I'd be arrested about a dozen or so more times. Those days and nights that I spent in jail, those would be the only days and nights that I would draw a sober breath. I was never far from alcohol or anything else. And so by the summer of 2009, my powerlessness and unmanageability, it has brought me to the streets. I'm now living on the streets of Hollywood, sleeping underneath a park bench. And what's happening in my life at this time is exactly what it talks about in the doctor's opinion, you know, where I cannot, after a time, differentiate the truth from the false, right? And what the truth is in my life at this time is that I'm participating in things that I don't want to participate in, and I'm doing these things with people I don't want to be doing it with. And the false is the lie that I'm telling myself. that I could stop this whenever I want to. I just don't want to. And so, I'm turning tricks in a motel parking lot, and my my life is so unmanageable. I can't even manage to show up for work, and nobody likes an escort that that doesn't show up. And in October of 2009, I'm arrested once again, and once again, I'm up in front of that judge, and once again, that judge is reading me charges. He's violating my probation again. And finally he slams my folder shut and he slides it across his table and he says, you know what, I'm done with you. And he starts sentencing me to a year in jail. But as he's doing that, he stopped kind of like midway through, you know, and he says, you know, I'll let you serve your time if you go to a sober living. This was a weird phrase, right? These are two words I've never heard side by side each other in a sentence before, right? This sober living, okay? Like, okay, fine. Living, all I'm doing at this moment in my life is existing, right? But sober, like, the only thing that I know about sobriety is that it's an absolute nightmare. I mean, you take alcohol away from me and it's like you're holding me underwater and I can't breathe. And I need to breathe. I need to survive. I need to drink. That judge gave me 30 days to check into a sober living, be back in his courtroom, test clean and sober, or else he'd put me in jail for a year. And over the course of the next 30 days, I'd come to know the cunning, baffling, powerful nature of this disease that we call alcoholism. And that's the baffling nature of drinking while trying so desperately hard not to drink. And I couldn't do it. And on November 25th of 2009, my sister, she found me on the streets of Hollywood and she took me to a sober living. And, and you know, I remember just putting my head on that pillow that night. And I don't know, maybe I was just glad that like I was putting myself, my head on a pillow and I had sheets and covers and there was actually a bed that I was sleeping on. I don't know. Maybe it was that. But for some reason, when I went to bed that night, I felt like everything was going to be okay for the first time in a long time. That feeling quickly changed in the morning. I believe I was woken up to my roommate burping and farting at the same time, which I don't know is a thing. I just quickly realized, this may have been a mistake, you know? And I'd love to stand before you tonight and tell you that, you know, I launched into this course of rigorous action, but I didn't. You know? I didn't. I was a guy, I just sat in meetings and, you know, I'd fold my arms and I'd look at the ground, you know. And I remember I was about 30 days sober and this guy was sitting behind me in a minute meeting and he starts sharing, you know, and he starts sharing about that voice that's in his head. And I'm like, oh my gosh, these people in Alcoholics Anonymous are crazy, and he's right behind me. And then he starts like talking about you know how you have that voice too, and I'm like, oh my gosh, no, he's trying to like take us all down with him. Like, what voice, you know? And then he says, if you're wondering what I'm talking about, it's that voice that just went, what voice? And I went, what? You know, I spun around like I couldn't believe that, right? Like that's the voice that's been there my entire life. That's the voice that's been telling me, you know what, Michael, it's that bar and those people that you're drinking. We should go drink with these people over here. Or, you know, that voice that told me, you know what, Michael, they're more fun when you drink, you know, or I'm more fun when I drink. Or it's that voice that would tell me, you know what, Michael, tonight we're just going to have one drink. And it won every single time. And now you're telling me that you have that voice too. Like I couldn't believe it. And that voice, that day, it got a little bit quieter. And it started to get a little bit more comfortable. But, you know, I didn't follow it up with any action. I didn't read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Certainly didn't get into any of these steps. I just went back to meetings with my arms folded, looking at the ground, you know. Oh, I think that's a new hole in my shoe. You know? And so around 60 days sober, you know, I came out of the closet when I was like 16 years old, and you know, since then I participated in rallies. I've marched on our state capitol. I've held signs that said, "Just because I'm gay, that doesn't make me any different from you." And then I get to Alcoholics Anonymous, and all of a sudden I'm like, "Oh, wait a minute, I'm different from you." you don't understand, right? You know, and I got all this stuff going on in my head. I'm 60 days sober, you know, and I remember this guy, he's sharing in this meeting, and I can't tell you what he said before this, and I certainly can't tell you what he said after this, but what I heard him say that day, that this is Alcoholics Anonymous. And here, we look for the similarities and not the differences. Because when you start looking at the differences, you'll see yourself as different, and you'll difference yourself right out those doors. And the same program of Alcoholics Anonymous that worked for me is not going to work for you. And I heard it that day. I heard that man that day. And that voice in my head, it got a little bit quieter. And I got a little bit more comfortable. But again, I didn't follow it up with any action. I wasn't helping other alcoholics. Certainly wasn't calling a sponsor that I had. I just went back to meetings, arms folded, looking at the ground. Yep, that's definitely no hope. And so by 90 days sober, there's been no spiritual experience. There's been no change sufficient enough to bring about recovery. Now I'm going absolutely insane. I'm going absolutely insane. And what's happening to me at this time in my life is like there's no alcohol in me and there's no recovery in me. And I got to go. And all I'm doing is I'm just looking at the ground. In meetings, I'm not listening to what you're saying. I'm not listening to the music of Alcoholics Anonymous and what you people are trying to tell me. And what you guys were telling me is that I suffer from a soul sickness, that I have a spiritual malady. And instead of treating it with the spiritual program behind the steps and that's in the book, I've been treating it with alcohol, which is the synthetic experience. And I'm not hearing that. So I got to go. And I'm 92 days sober. I'm sitting in this meeting. And I gotta go. I have to drink. I don't have a choice. I don't have this choice. I remember I was taking a chip for 90 days. I walk up, you know, I took this chip and everybody's clapping like we do, you know, go keep coming back, you know. And I'm just like, you know, because that's very much how I was when I was new. I was just like, get away from me, you know, and it's, you know, everybody's like, it's good to see you. And I'm like, you know, and I always hated that. You know, it's like, you know, that's why I love Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it's like there was a genuine, like when I was new, everybody's like, it's good to see you. And they were telling me the truth. And I knew for some reason they were telling me the truth that it's good because it wasn't a, yeah, good to see you. You know, it was just a genuine good to see, you know. So, but I'd still be like, you know, and I'd run off. You know, but so, you know, I take this chip and I'm walking back to my seat. Right. And I'm walking back and this woman, she stands up, she gets in my path and she puts her hands on my shoulders. And she goes, you are the miracle, you know, and I just wanted to throw punch her. I want to throw her on the ground, kick her a couple times and run out of that meeting. I wanted to run out of that meeting. I would go to the liquor store and I wanted a drink because that's all I knew how to change the way that I was feeling inside. I didn't know anybody any other way, you know, and I sit down and remember, I'm just like, my fists are clenched so tight, I'm seething mad. And like this guy sitting next to me goes, bro, you got to call your sponsor. I'm like, I would throw punch you too, man. Don't you start with me, you know? I feel so sorry for the people in Covina 14 years ago. But I took the most contrary action I've ever taken in my life up until that point. And I did something that somebody else told me to do. And I called my sponsor. And I will be forever grateful that the man that I asked to sponsor me at 14 days sober because I had to get a sponsor was a man who knew his responsibility in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is when the hand of a dying alcoholic reached out and asked you for help, that you are the one that is responsible. That man came over and he took me through steps 1, 2, and 3 that night. And I'll never forget, you know, when he left me that night, he looked into my eyes. He looks right into my alcoholic soul and he said, Michael, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Go find God now. I love that part that we read in chapter 5. I love that line. You know, it's telling us when to find God. You know, it's not telling us to find God next week. It's not telling us to find God when we're on a hike or at the beach. And the sun is hitting the horizon at just the right time, you know. It's not telling us to find God after this meeting or when we're ready. I hate that one. It's telling us to find God now because this is where God is in this moment, right here, right now. I went to bed that night. I did something I hadn't done since I was a little boy. And I got down on my knees and I prayed. I prayed to a God that I didn't have, but to a God that I so desperately needed. And I said, God, please, please, I will do anything. Just please keep me sober. You know, at 92 days sober, I didn't know what to do. I had no clue what I needed to do. And you guys took me by the hands and you showed me precisely what I needed to do. And, you know, my sponsor, he didn't sit me down and go, okay, Michael, these are the 12 steps and we're going to do this, this, and this. And around this, there, and there, where it's going to have take this long and that long. And he didn't. You know, he got me a big book and we sat down and I'd read a little bit and he'd read a little bit. And then I'd read some and he'd read some. And then when we got to a step, we'd work it, you know? And it didn't take a long conversation for me to be convinced that I had this insane relationship with alcohol. Do you know the pitiful and incomprehensible, demoralizing things that I have done for a drink? And that I would continue to demoralize myself just to have another drink? It wasn't a long conversation. I was convinced about it. I was convinced that I had an insane relationship with alcohol. And then he asked me a few questions, you know? He asked me a couple of questions. He said, Michael, are you willing to believe? Do you now believe, or are you willing to believe that there was a power greater than yourself? And I, you know, it was a little late that night and I was a little tired and I just went, yeah, I guess so. You know, yeah, sure. I didn't know. I didn't know that just that little bit amount of willingness was all that I needed. All I needed to lay this foundation for this spiritual structure to be built on. I didn't know that. And we get back in the boat, we read a little bit more, you know, and we got down on our knees. We said this prayer. We get back in our seats, you know, and we thought long and hard about taking this critical step. And I'm like, wait a minute, what step? What did we just do? You know, and he go, oh, Michael, shiny object, back in the book. You know, and I'm like, okay, you know, and we get back in the book and we read a little bit more. And it says, in dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. And we close the book and he gave me a notepad and a pen. He said, okay, Michael, I want you to write down everybody you're mad at and why. And I went, yes, you know, like this is. I love AA now, right? Because I've been waiting my entire life for somebody to come up to me and go, okay, Michael, tell me everybody you're mad at and why. You know, I've been telling people anyways whether they wanted to hear it or not, you know? And now somebody's finally giving me a pen and paper. They're going, here, yeah, tell me everybody, all of them and why, you know? And so I'm just, you know, and I write, I would do it, you know? He would ask me, you know, okay, Michael, well, when can you have that done by? And I'd be like, 3 days. And he'd go, okay, Michael, part of integrity is doing what we say we're going to do. And I'd be like, okay, 5 days, give me 5 days, you know? And, you know, I'd come back to him a few days later and I'd be like, I'm done. You know, we get back in the book and we read a little bit more instruction, right? And I'd write another column. I'd be finished with that. We'd get back in the book, read a little bit. And then we just, and then one Sunday morning, you know, he's picking me up and he's taking me to his house. And over the course of the next 5 hours, I'm telling him the exact nature of my wrongs. And we begin to build a new me. A human being that's built on a foundation of spiritual principles. Remember, he was taking me back home, and he pulls over at this park, and which was like a block away from my sober living. He pulls over at this park, and we get out my book, and we open to page 75, and we read that paragraph. He says, okay, Michael, this is your instruction for the next hour. And I was to ask myself, I was to sit quiet for an hour and ask myself a series of questions on each step. Right? Have I skimped on anything? Have I built mortar without sand? Right? And he just told me, just repeat that for an hour. Ask yourself on step one, step two, step three, step four, step five. Two. And I remember I was sitting under this tree and, you know, and I'm asking myself, this is kind of dumb. Okay, whatever, I'll do it. Whatever, I'll do it. I'll do what he says, you know. And you know, I'm sitting on this tree and I'm asking myself, is step one and step two? And what began to happen was I began to kind of slip into this guided meditation, you know. And I remember just sitting there going over it. And it was there underneath that tree that, you know, I realized it, that there it was, God. I met God that day. And it was in me. It was in me this whole time. The book talks about the deep down inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It's been me in me this whole time. And I didn't know. I didn't know it was just covered by the lies that I've been doing, the manipulating and the selfishness and the self-centeredness. I don't know, but once when we break those away layer by layer, you know, there he is. It's just been a beautiful journey. And I got to tell you, you know, if you're new, listen, you know, welcome. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. And some weird things might happen around here. You just got to go with it, okay? You know. Remember this one time I was like standing outside of a meeting and I'm smoking a cigarette. I'm kind of holding the wall up a little bit. And then, you know, a long time after the meeting's been over for a while, parking lot's kind of empty. And this guy in his car pulls up. He rolls his window down. He goes, hey, you, work your third step and get in the car. And I'm like, okay, so do I work my third step and then get into his car? Do I get into his car and then work my third step? And then, like, that's not my sponsor. Can I cross sponsor like that? And, like, all this stuff is bouncing around in my newcomer head, right? And he goes, hey, kid, get in the car. Okay, so when I was in the third grade, right, this cop came to our school and he gathered us all like into this building just like this in this assembly. And he told us this. He said, I promise this is going to happen to one of you. One day, a man is going to pull up in a car. He's going to roll his window down. He's going to say, hey, kid, get in the car. And the only thing you are to do is scream and run. And I froze. I couldn't believe that it was happening to me, you know? There were like 100 kids at that assembly that day, and it was happening to me. I was like, this is the coolest thing in the world, you know? So I got in the car. Let's see what Johnny 5-0 doesn't want me to find out, you know? In the car, and I'm like, where are we going? Where are you taking me? And he goes, I'm taking you to an institution. I'm like, get me out of this car, you know? And he goes, relax, kid. I'm taking you on a panel. I'm going to take you to an institution. We're going to go. We're going to take a meeting to where some people can't get out. We're going to meet themselves, you know? And that's just what I started to do, you know? I just started to get into the car. You know, I'd get in the car and we go hear your sponsor speak somewhere. Or I'd get in the car and we'd go to a weekend big book workshop, you know, or I'd get in the car and we'd go on a 12-step call. You know, some of the greatest things in AA happen in the car, you know. I just love it, you know. And one day, you know, I got in the car and these guys, these group of guys, they were taking me up to this men's spiritual retreat up in Big Bear that happens in April. And I don't remember much from this weekend. I'm sure it's very spiritual and all. But what I remember so much from this weekend, what changed my sobriety that weekend was I shared a room with a guy named John, and John and I became very close, good friends. And tragically, he passed away a number of years ago. He died sober. But I remember this one night, it was Saturday night, it was about 10 till midnight, and we're on our beds, we're just talking, and I was just so in awe of John on this night, because on this night, at the stroke of midnight, in 10 minutes, John was going to get 1 year sober. And I remember, I just, like, screw you guys with your 10s, your 20s, your 30 years sober, right? That's unattainable to me. But here in front of me is John, and he's going to get 1 year sober, you know? So I'm like firing off all these questions, right? Like, how do you feel? Do you feel any different? Where were you exactly 1 year ago today, you know? And I still love to ask him, you know, guys, when they take a year, you know, that question. But I remember I got quiet because I wanted to ask him this one question, but I was really scared of what his response was going to be, you know? And I finally mustered up enough courage, and I asked him. I said, John, do you think that I can get 1 year sober? And John was, you know, he was a very meticulous guy. You know, John, he used to always think about his response before he spoke. And I remember he kind of sat there a little bit. And he stroked his goatee that he had a little bit. And he says, I'm just doing what the guys before me have done. So I suppose if you do what I do and I keep doing what they do, then yeah, you can get 1 year sober too. Did you hear that? Did you hear what John told me that night? Yeah. John told me that night that if you do what I do, you'll live. If you do what I do, you will live. Can you say that? Are you living your life in a way that you can tell a newcomer, do what I do and you'll live? John was. John was absolutely living his life in a way that he could tell a newcomer, me, do what I do and you'll live. So I did. I followed John everywhere. I did exactly what John was doing. Exactly what John was doing, right? I'm gonna do it, right? And it turns out John was just doing five things. Number one, John was going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Number two, John had commitments at those meetings. Number three, he had a sponsor at those meetings. Number four, he was working the steps of that sponsor. Number five, and most importantly, John was trying to help other alcoholics. And by doing those five things, what happened was I was living my life in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. No matter what happens in my life today, I treat my alcoholism first, and then I deal with the rest. When I was 7 years sober, I tested positive for HIV. And like that, my life got different. Remember, I took a friend who was to get tested, and he was really nervous and scared. And so I said I'd go with him. And it had been 6 months since my last test. So I thought, well, I'll get tested too. Why not? You know, and you know, they swab your mouth. They take a little bit of blood from you. And then they make you wait in this waiting room for like 20 minutes to do a sex inventory. You're like, you know, and you know, and they called my friend back, and he came out a couple of minutes later, gave me the double thumbs up, and they're like, "Ooh, you know, thank goodness." You know, they called me back, they put me in a room, and they said your first test came back reactive. So we took a more conclusive, closer look at your blood to confirm that you have HIV. And I just wanted that woman to stop talking. You know, I wanted her to stop talking. You know, long enough that I don't have to deal with this, yeah. Long enough that this doesn't have to be true. I wanted her to stop talking long enough so that I wouldn't be in this crippling fear that's coming over me. And I left there. It was a Friday evening, you know, you know, can't get a hold of a doctor till like Monday, you know, and it was a Friday evening. And I remember just standing by my car, what am I going to do? What am I going to do now? You know, and I had a commitment at my home group that night. I was the literature guy. And the only reason I was the literature guy was because the literature guy before me, he would sometimes not come to the meeting. And I think it's like so irresponsible to have a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous without any literature. So I raised this point at our business meeting. And they all said, okay, Michael, if you think you could do such a good job, then you take the literature. And I said, fine, I will. I will take the literature commitment. I will be here each and every week. And I will set the literature up. You'll watch, you know, and now all I want to do is I want to go home. I want to go home. I want to hide from you. I want to hide from myself. And I want to hide from God. But I just made this really big stink at my business meeting. So I went. They say you can't save your ass and your face at the same time. But I disagree, you know, because I did both that night. Didn't want them thinking bad of me. And I did. And I remember at the end of that meeting, we took a moment of silence for the alcoholic who still suffers. And I remember in that moment, I just closed my eyes and I said, God, please remove this fear and direct my attention to what you would have me be. And my next thought and intuition was, you know, there are three newcomers here tonight who took newcomers. I bet they don't have a book. So I bought them a book and I told them when we were going to read the big book. You ever ask a newcomer if they want to read the book? They're like, oh, I have to pick up my mom from space, you know? Suddenly they become like so busy, right? I will die drunk asking a newcomer if they want to read the book with me. You know, I tell them when we're going to read the book, and that's just what I did, you know? Each meeting I went to, I just, you know, I talked to newcomers. I took dozens and dozens of new guys through the first 164 pages and the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I treat my alcoholism first, and then I deal with the rest. Because it was you guys. You guys that told me that when all else fails, Michael, you help another alcoholic. And I have. And I'm here to tell you that you could stay sober too, no matter what. You know, time's just about up here. So I just want to end with this, tell you this little story. I've got this, four-year-old nephew, and he's just just a part of my big world. And he's a big part of it. And we've got a really close relationship. You know, my sister, she's a single woman. She did IVF, and I was there when the kid was born, and you know, I just love this kid to death. I recently took him. He's really into dinosaurs these days, and so recently I took him to this Jurassic Quest experience, you know, where they have like these life-size dinosaurs and they're on animatronics and stuff like that. And they move and all this stuff. And I remember I was holding them and we were going through this one like spot and we had to cross this bridge to get to the other side to get outside. And I could see the other side, but the kid had his head buried in my face and he's holding me really tight because, you know, and there's raptors on each side of this. They're like, you know, going like this. And he's just got his head buried in my chest. He's like squeezing me so tight. And he looks at me and goes, "Uncle, I'm scared." And I go, "I know you are, buddy, but I can see the other side and you're going to be okay." You know, I just walked across the bridge. And that's my relationship with God today. God carries me wherever I go. And when I get scared, I just squeeze God a little bit tighter. And I say, "God, I'm scared." He goes, "I know you are, buddy, but I can see the other side and you're going to be okay. I was so scared when I came to you. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and at 92 days sober, I begged you to change the way that I was feeling. And you good people of Alcoholics Anonymous, knowing full well that no human power could release my alcoholism, you took me by the hand and you placed me in the arms of a God, loving God of my own understanding. And for that, I will walk to the ends of Alcoholics of this earth for Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you so much. I appreciate you all."